on shortwave, AM, FM, and the internet. This is PCJ. Yeah! It's now time for the Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Perrone.
Oh, no!
Hello everywhere, welcome again to another edition of the International Happy Station Show. I'm your host Keith Perron, here with you for the next 55 minutes. Yes, your lucky number. Anyway, today's show is going to be a lot of fun because I have a special guest standing by. And I'm not going to tell you right away what it is, but I will give you three clues and I'll see if you can maybe, you know, put it together. The clues are, okay, family. Second clue is documentary. And third clue is the art of storytelling. Uh-huh. Now, many of you, I can hear your brain waves emanating through the microphone at this end. So I know that you are thinking and you're probably wondering, what is all that about? Well, stay tuned. And it's something that you'll definitely enjoy. It's very special, very unique, and absolutely extraordinary. The next thing is to answer a question, and I want to begin by this right away. A recent letter that came to us from a listener in Slovakia was asking how we record the show. And yes, it's true, we do record the show in one take, meaning what you hear is exactly the same thing that what we hear in the studio. We don't voice track. I mean, I don't come in and spend 2-3 hours and record a bunch of voice tracks and then give it to our technician and say, okay, just mix it in and then take the next 3 weeks off. No, we don't do that. We actually record the show as if it was going live. Of course, there are times that we have to stop for whatever reason. And today, we happened to, well, actually, we started recording about, maybe 45 minutes ago, and then we stopped because something happened outside the studio. Something very unusual that one of our listeners had written in before with a question about. And just oddly enough, it just happened today, 45 minutes ago, and we were only maybe 10 or 15 minutes into the show, and I said, well, look, let's stop and let's change a few things around. So we're going to find out what happened and what was going on outside the studio as we managed to rig a very long cable outside. And we'll find out exactly what that is. Next thing I want to do is I want to say hello to a couple of new listeners to the Happy Station. Well, not exactly new listeners, but it's the first time that they've wrote in. They are Sven Pencheski, who is in London. He is originally from the from Stateside in Chicago. I was going blank there for a moment, and I don't know why. The next listener is Stor Hendrik Ekblom in Sweden. Now, staying in Sweden, I also want to wish congratulations to Magnus and Marie, who have finally decided to get married, and they sent an email to us saying the wedding is on August the 14th in Lapland in northern Sweden, so if any of you are going to be in the land of Smorgasbord, just pop up to the north and you can say hello to them. In fact, actually, they're going to have two weddings, you know, one for, you know, family and very close friends in Sweden, and then the second wedding will be actually held in Shanghai, because both of them actually are working in Shanghai at the moment. So congratulations to the both of you. But my question is, since you're having two weddings, does that mean you're going to have two wedding anniversaries? And does it also mean that either, you know, both of you have to buy, you know, two wedding anniversary gifts once a year? I would think yes. And I'll support Marie on this one. Marie, yeah, just say yes. Say to Magnus, look, we have to have two wedding anniversaries once a year. So that means, Magnus, if you buy one gift, which is kind of ich, you have about a month to go by. So you can choose a nice gift for the second wedding anniversary. Okay. All right, let's begin with a piece of music. This was something that was requested not too long ago from a listener of ours in the Netherlands. His name is Jan. He wanted to hear something from Franz Metz. So we went into our archives and we found something. Oddly enough, not much of Franz Metz's recordings are on CD, which is a shame because he had a really good big band. Here's Franz Metz and his orchestra with the old standard Too Close for Comfort on the International Happy Station. From Holland, Franz Metz and his orchestra with Too Close for Comfort here, beginning today's edition of the International Happy Station. Okay, now, before we took a listen to that, I was telling you about sort of how we record the show, and that something happened outside the studio. So just to tell you a bit of what happened, we came in, we started doing the show, we actually were running some clips that listeners sent in with some greetings, and then we heard this noise. And it wasn't a regular noise that went on maybe just for like a split second. It continued. It literally continued. So we grabbed the microphone and we went outside to find out what it is. So let's take a little listen to what we recorded just a moment ago. That sound is probably coming through very, very clearly. What that is exactly is the annual air raid drill that takes place here in Taipei, usually in the month of June. One day a year, for about 30 minutes, the entire city shuts down. And this is done in case of a missile attack from the People's Republic of China. Now, it is quite interesting to see, because right now, from my vantage point, cars are literally pulling to the side of the road, and people are asked to go indoors. And if you're in a public space, you are asked to seek shelter in one of the local MRT stations or metro stations. Anyway, let's continue now with more music here on the International Happy Station Show as I make my way back to the studio for the continuation of today's program.
You say I need a rest, why don't I go and see my sister way out west? Very thoughtful of you, dear. I'm really touched by all this tenderness. But us women are suspicious things. We know that men aren't born with wings. What's making you so kind? Now, I'm not smart, but I'm not blind. I think that you've got evil on your mind. You think that you've been good about as long as most red-blooded he-men could. We've been together for so long, I know another's pasture's looking good. Don't think that other men don't look at me that certain way from time to time. Think that you're the only one that must contend with evil on your mind. Your mind is set on a harem and surrounded by exotic dancing girls. You're hearing pretty music as they run their slender fingers through your curls. Ah, cling on, baby! Thank you for the flowers and the candy, honey, that was very kind. For that's your way of telling me you're sorry for the evil on your mind. Evil on your mind.
The wonderful Ella Fitzgerald and Evil on Your Mind here on the International Happy Station. Some of you have been commenting saying, Keith, you talk too much. There's too much talk on the show. We want to hear more music. Well, we actually have a full music show coming up very soon with a number of requests that have come in from actually some very odd places. I just recently found out that there is a station in Botswana that is carrying the program. To my surprise and to my happiness, actually, but that, yes, quite unique. I love Botswana. I've been there once before. But anyway, we do have a special music show coming up for you about music from Africa in a couple of weeks from now. Anyway, at the beginning of the show, I was telling you about our topic today and a guest that is standing by. And I gave three clues. One of the clues was the art of storytelling. Now, I'm going to run something right now, and I want you to listen carefully because, well, I think the clip is very self-explanatory. Let's take a listen to it.
I was up Glenscow. I was doing nothing, sitting at the car. Two-way radio. She was calling. I call him. And this brings tears in my eyes. I hear this woman crying for help. She's at the call. Every person with a boat, that our child was out there in 6'4". And next thing, I called her back. I said, I'll go for your kids. She's something like that. She was so happy. She couldn't believe it. I went over for him. I got a volunteer. And it was real, real rough day. Roughest time I ever saw it.
Now, I'm sure that some of you out there right now are thinking one of two things. Either it's an audiobook or it's a radio drama. No, it isn't. It isn't one of those two things. It, in fact, is just a regular person, the kind of person that we meet every day when we go about our daily lives. Now, there is a Vancouver-based company called Life Tales, which is absolutely fascinating because what they do, they can take, let's say, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your grandparents, anybody in your family. They interview the person and they put together a documentary about the person's life that the family can hold on for years, even after the person has passed on. It is very unique and very, very special. And when I came across the website, which we'll give out at the end of the interview, I was totally amazed by it. Because when you go to the website, the first three things you see is your story, your voice, your legacy. I was also very surprised to find out that the woman who created Life Tales is somebody that I've, well, first met almost 20 years ago. Actually, a little bit more than 20 years ago. Her name is Susan Elrington. She is a broadcaster. She also worked for CKUT in Montreal, where she was the station manager, and worked for CBC in British Columbia. Susan, thank you very much for joining us. I want to begin by asking you about Life Tales, and where did you get the idea to do this?
Well, it came from my own experience, Keith. My mom passed away more than 10 years ago, and I had left and sent a number of emails to her brother, who lives in England, and he hadn't responded to me, and he finally left me a voice message on the machine, and he's Irish, and as my mum was, and had that wonderful accent with it, where he left the voice message saying, "Oh, Susie, I'm sorry I haven't got back to you, but, you know, it's been unmercifully busy around here," and it just kind of stabbed me through my heart, because it was my mum's voice almost saying that. And then tried something my mother would have tried, which is, and you know how the internet doesn't work at night, you know, as to why he hadn't sent back an email. And it just made me miss my mum so much. And at that moment, I would have given anything to hear her voice reciting the phone book, let alone telling me anything that I thought was important. And I thought, well, I don't have that with my mom. In fact, the most I have of her on a voice is on a video saying, "Turn that thing off," because she hated to be filmed with anything. And I thought, you know, I may not be able to do it for myself now, but I could certainly do it for other people. And it just was born. The idea was born in that moment, and it sort of all fell into place really, really quickly. I spent many years in radio, and one of the things I loved most was really sitting down and hearing people's stories. And so I thought that would be a terrific thing to do. And so I started. I started with my dad, and it was a really interesting experience to do that because I learned an awful lot from it. The first thing I learned is that you're not necessarily the best person to interview your own family, and which was really interesting, and for a couple of reasons. One is, I tended to fill in the blanks mentally, so I didn't necessarily ask the most natural next question because I already knew some of the answer. Mm-hmm. And when I went to edit the material, I realized, there's large parts of the story that really aren't recorded. And I realized that there's a good reason for bringing somebody else in to interview your family member and bring that fresh perspective to it. And the other part is that generally, your parents or your relatives have already decided what their story is going to be for you. I had a filmmaker once say to me that he's tried many times to interview his mother, and he's so frustrated because he can't get any more out of her than he already knows. And I said, that's because so long ago she made up her mind what she was going to tell you. And that's not going to change because you've got a microphone or a camera in front of her. Having somebody else come in and ask a question can turn that on its ear sometimes.
Well, this leads me to the question then. I mean, when you're preparing to interview somebody, what is it that you look for? I mean, who do you speak to beforehand? Do you speak to other family members to try to get some basic information? Or when you interview that person, do you want to hear the story they're telling you for the first time so you would know then what to ask?
Yeah, it's a combination of the two. And in truth, it kind of depends who's hiring me. In some cases, it's the person themselves who's doing their story, and so I might spend a little bit more time with them. In other cases, it's kids who are hiring me to do their parents' stories, and certain parts of their parents' lives are important to them to preserve. That might not be their parents' first choice, but they're the ones who want to preserve that. So there's a bit of it depends on that, but I will sit down and have a consultation, and we'll talk about which stories they want included in the life tales. And I'll ask enough to give me a sketch of the story, but I really don't want to hear details at that point. I want those to come out in the interview. So the consultation usually takes about an hour, and you know, certain things will come up out of it. I had one woman who hired me to do one of her mom. And when we did the consultation, we were going over the stories, and her mom and her dad had divorced at one point. And she said, I don't need to ask any questions about that because I lived through the divorce. I don't need to know anything about it. That's fine. And but spending the time with her mom that way, when it came to doing the interview, I did ask her mom why she had married this woman's father in the first place. And she gave a really interesting answer about having lived in a small town, and really, in a way, he was her ticket out and that sort of thing. And when I gave the finished product to the daughter, she said, I have asked my mom my whole life about that, and she's been so determined to never speak poorly of my father that she would just always avoid the question and say, oh, it doesn't matter because I got you out of it and you're the sunshine of my life. And so you kind of have to bring what they want, but also assess a little bit whether there's a little bit more ground to cover. That was an essential part of this woman's story. And so the question was asked, and there was a way to include it where the daughter enjoyed it rather than it reflecting bringing up bad memories.
So it seems like there's that many times there are, because we just talked about this, how sometimes our parents will tell us one thing because they've been telling us, you know, our entire lives, but they don't want to, you know, include too many facts in the story. But you go into a situation and you get a lot of information that is different. Have you ever had, let's say, that was a positive response, but has it happened where you get a negative response, where somebody will say, you know, I really don't want to hear that. I'd rather leave it out.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's part of what I think I bring to doing this process, and part of why any personal historian, you should, if you're thinking about engaging a personal historian, you should really take some time to sit with that person and make sure that they're the right person for you to do this project, because part of what I think I bring to it is an assessment of the relationship between the parents and children. When people divulge things that are unexpected, I'll say to them, is this something that you want to be part of it? And it's interesting because as part of the whole process of telling your story, there's a certain therapy that goes with that, I think. There's a certain sense of release, especially if you've said things that you've thought for a long time and hadn't said before. And in some cases, people will say, no, I want this to be part of my story that's left behind. In other cases, they'll say, no, they just don't want to leave any sense of hurt for their children. And I entirely respect that. This is entirely your story, so you direct that in a sense. But having said that, there has to be, I don't know how I can say it, an element of truth to doing this. It's very interesting because I'm grappling with one now where I had an interview with a fellow, and he told me something fairly traumatic that happened to him, and as I've been able to check out facts, I realize it's actually not true. The details of what he told me are not true. The trauma may have been a similar trauma, but the people he said were involved weren't involved. And in fact, there's a lot of things in the whole story, his whole story, he told me, that are hard to believe. And so I'm very much grappling with putting it together, because if it doesn't have an element or a sense of truth even to that person themselves, you really can't feel that you're telling the story. I hope that's not sounding unclear.
No, it does. And it almost sounds that in some ways, even though you're not a therapist, it's almost like you're doing that kind of work in some way.
Well, it is. In fact, I realized with this one that I'm grappling with, I could probably go back and over the course of a couple of years really push and nudge and that sort of thing and get to some sort of truth with this fellow. But I'm not a therapist. That's actually not my role to do with this. And so I've essentially decided to tell him that I will, you know, edit the raw interview to take out the ahs and ums and that sort of thing. But I can't put together that arc of a story for him because it simply isn't, it doesn't, it's not real. It's not even his truth. And you know that, you start to understand that. And so that really guides me in what I'm doing. And you, when somebody says to me, this is important to me or I don't know how to describe it. It's just, you recognize it when you see it and the absence of it makes the whole project impossible.
Now let's move on to the process and the project itself. How does it work? I mean, if I was to call you and I said, look, Susan, I want to leave something behind for my family. What do you do from that point?
Okay, so, and I will make the point here that 90% of it is you coming, it would be our clients coming to me saying, I want to capture my parents' stories before they're gone. And so, so actually I very rarely deal with the parent first, but what I will do is we'll sit down and talk about what kinds of stories, which stories they want to have included. What I usually produce, although it can be tailor-made, is a 60-minute, one-hour CD. And that will include sound effects and music so that it takes you through the story of somebody's life. If they want to do two CDs, that's possible too. But it seems to be my experience that with the one-hour CD, that's the right amount of time for a family to gather and listen. And then we'll talk about what's important to them. So in some cases, there are a lot of stories of immigration to Canada. They are, we've had a number of people who have come from Europe. In fact, I just did one of a 92-year-old woman who immigrated from Holland. And so those are usually a big story because that's a big transition point in people's lives. How they met their mates and it's funny how much people can't remember about how they met their mate when life goes on. Usually having kids and the things that were important to them in life. This Life Tales is not just a chronological recitation of I was born in such and such, I moved here on this date, I didn't, you know, I went to the school on that date. It's a reflection on your life more than that. So you might say, for example, the 92-year-old woman spoke about not being able to go beyond grade 9 in school because her father said to her, you know, all you need to know for the rest of your life to be a wife, you can now learn from your mother. And she probably would have longed to have been a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of stuff that comes up in those sorts of things. So we'll talk about what kinds of stories. And then about a week later, because usually once people go through that process, they'll remember other things they want to include as well. And so about a week later, we'll sit down for 2 or 3 hours and we'll talk. We'll do the interview. And then I take it from there and do the editing, add the music, add the sound effects and so on and so forth.
We just fell into each other's arms that night when we were introduced. It's just without even, we hadn't even been drinking, so it was just a natural reaction. We were just really attracted to each other right from the start.
It's wonderful.
It was because I was beautiful and I had nice legs. No. But it was because I could talk about politics and religion and whatever. And he was fun, you know. He had a good sense of humor, and it was a perfect relationship. Actually, it was. I mean, he did like my legs too.
Now, there it must be interesting to, you know, when you're doing it, because you know we were listening to some of the samples that you have on the website, which we'll give out later. And I was talking with one of my colleagues about this, and we both said, you know, if this was like a radio series, we would listen, because even though I don't know these people, I find it fascinating. I absolutely find it fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. It's the best. I think it's the best of what I loved about doing journalism was, you know, peeling off the layers of the onion. But people have lived such extraordinary lives. And you know what? The extraordinary thing is, Keith, most of the time they don't realize it. One woman that I did her life tale for, it was for her birthday. She sat with her family and friends and listened to it and then turned to them all afterwards and said, "Well, I've lived a far more interesting life than I thought I had." And it is that sense, because I was excited about the things that she had done and the part way her life had gone, that when it's reflected back, people see things in it that they hadn't even realized were there in the first place, which is also really exciting. And some of the stories are just, you know, they get your heart, they get your funny bone, that you laugh, and it's the whole range of human experience.
You know, not too long ago, I was scheduled to do an interview with someone who'd worked at Radio Netherlands for many years, but in the last few years, he's been suffering from Alzheimer's, and he would have good days and he would have bad days. At the end of the day, we decided not to do it because we wanted people to remember him for what he was and not what has happened to him in the last few years. Have you interviewed people before where, you know, the children would say, you know, look, you know, Dad has good days, sometimes he's bad. How do you cope with that?
When we're setting up the interview time, I always say to people, if they wake up in the morning and it's a bad day, we'll do it another time.
Right.
We'll always make another time, because it actually takes a fair amount of energy to be able to do it as well. And when you're talking about people who are in their 90s, I did one with a 99-year-old woman, and, you know, about 45 minutes and her energy would really flag. And what happens is the memories are harder to access.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get as much sort of emotional investment in the memory at that time. But it's very interesting what you say about that, because I did do a Life Tales with a woman who was in the early stages of dementia. And her niece hired me. She didn't have kids of her own. Her niece hired me. And this woman was had losing a lot of her short-term memory, but the long-term memories were still pretty much intact. So it was a harder interview process, because there was a lot of detouring and getting off point and so on. And in that sense, I collected a lot more tape, and it was a longer interview than I normally would have done. But the memories were all there. And she'd lived a fascinating life. She was a Quaker. She'd met the love of her life. She'd gone off to Africa and taught in Kenya for years in the 60s with him, and started food co-ops in Victoria. She was a really fascinating woman, and had a great sense of humor and so on. And so when we did the time, because it usually takes a 2 or 3 months to do the editing and put it together. And by the time we did that, her niece took it back and listened to it with her. Her memory was such that she had no memory whatsoever of the interview being done. And so she was truly puzzled about where her niece had got this from. But she was also fascinated. And there were some really interesting things out of it. One was that her niece, when she arrived that day, her aunt was in a bad mood, very grumpy. It was a bad day. And by putting this on and listening to it, it turned her aunt's mood around right away. She became quite interested in it and very lively about it. It also prompted a lot of conversation between the niece and aunt, which was really great in terms of using those memory muscles mm-hmm. at that stage of dementia, which is really important. And the other thing that the niece said to me, which I thought was, I had not thought of at all, she said, you know, my aunt's going to be going into a nursing home probably within a year easily. And she said, I worry, because I think sometimes all the staff will know about her is that she's this grumpy old woman. And she said, now I can get them to listen to this, and they will know that she is so much more of that, even if it's hidden right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really terrific. And in fact, have spoken to the university here about possibly setting up a research study to see if indeed this could help to trigger memory. Because it's a different thing to have it in your own vocabulary, your own intonation, your own voice, and your own words, than somebody telling you, remember, you grew up on a farm. But if you have that memory and that sort of mind picture, I think it could, much as music can trigger memory, it might be able to also trigger memory. So that was a really interesting experience.
Have you ever had people come to you later on and say, you know, Susan, since you did the project, I am now communicating with my parents differently than I was before?
Yes, it's interesting. I did one. Actually, I was somewhat intimidated to do this one because the kids had hired me to do their mom and dad were both turning 60 in the same year, and so they wanted me to do their parents. And the mom was a psychiatrist, and so I thought, oh no, she's going to know all my interviewing techniques. She's going to know how to hold back and so on. But she was a lovely woman, and she opened up. She had worked very hard, along with her husband, to come to Canada, to build a big life, to come from people of little means into having more. And they'd done that through becoming doctors. And there was intense pressure from their families to do that. And so her kids, none of her kids had gone into the medical field. And when I asked the parents, well, how do you handle advising your kids when there aren't the same pressures for them to achieve as there were for you to achieve? And the father said, oh, as long as they're happy, I don't care what they do, it's fine. And the mother said, well, I do worry about them. I have those fears and anxieties because I've come from a place where you don't have a lot, and I don't want that for them. And so she said, I check in with them. You know, every once in a while I'll say, are you sure you're happy working at the bank? Or are you sure you're happy being a music therapist? And the kids will say, yes, we're okay. And then she says, and then I'm fine. As long as they're happy, I'm fine. And after the family had listened to the CD, the daughter said to me, you know, I always thought when she was asking me that she was disappointed in me that I hadn't become a doctor, that I had failed her somehow. And so now I know she's just doing it because she loves me. And I thought, oh, that's such a great gift. You know, the way we communicate as parents and children, sometimes it takes somebody who doesn't have that same emotional stake to come in, and you can hear it a little differently.
You're interviewing people and you're hearing stories for the first time, sometimes stories that the children or their family have never heard. Have any of them personally moved you? Have there been any stories that after you finish the interview, you just go, that was touching, or that was just really difficult?
I think one of the hardest ones I did, and in fact it was the second one I did after I did my father's, I went and did his neighbors, actually, and they told me, it was interesting because most people, when you do these, they talk quite a lot about their kids, and these people didn't talk a lot about their kids. And it turned out that there was a reason for that. There had been a particularly tragic incident with one of their kids. But one of the things that it made me really reflect on the sort of parent-child and the nature of children was it turned out that he had been adopted, which he didn't learn until he was drafted into the Second World War. And the papers were sent to him with the name of his mother being a different name from the mother that he knew. And when he inquired, that's when he learned he had been adopted. But of course, in those days, and he was off to war, they didn't record anything, and there was no hope of him finding who it was. He never found out who his mother was. And they ended up adopting two children themselves. And their children then ended up adopting other kids themselves. And it was really interesting because as his adopted daughter went through the process of adopting her own child and it was all open and there was knowledge about it and so on, it really caused him to reflect a lot on what his own sense of identity was. Mm-hmm. And I was very moved about how that wasn't an easy thing to do. He was in his 80s, and it was going through the process of doing this Life Tales that really brought that up for him. And I was really impressed with kind of the bravery and his willingness to allow himself to emotionally look at that, and very, very moved by that, because it's not an easy thing to do, to question your own identity in your 80s and to try and make all the pieces of your life fit together. And I was very moved by that.
What's really amazing about it, Susan, when, you know, these are just regular people, and yeah. You know, I think it would astonish anybody to think, you know, if I went to my neighbor next door and I said, look, I want to do a documentary about your life, they would probably look at me thinking that I was drinking, I was high or something, you know? But it's true, I think.
Exactly.
You know, but I think what you're doing proves a point that there are so many interesting stories out there from regular people that, you know, I think us as broadcasters, would be able to learn so much more sometimes if we even, you know, did this a little bit more often instead of doing the sensational stories which we see plastered everywhere.
Absolutely, Keith. I always think, you know, and now it's funny because I'll see the news story and I'm always intrigued by the sort of backstory of the players and so on. I'll see grandma in the story about a missing child or something, and I'm always looking and thinking, well, what in their life is this connecting with? And what's the impact on them? Because they bring a whole lot of other life experience to it. And you're right, there. I have not yet done a story with somebody where I thought, huh, they didn't have much to say. Every single person has had a lot to say, and everybody has had, and they don't see it themselves. That's the amazing thing to me. I just did an interesting one for a fellow who, in fact, the 92-year-old woman who had emigrated from Holland, and it was her son was wanting to do it for her. And his hope was that, in fact, I also made a kind of slideshow to the sound of the life tales. And his hope is that it will be there and can stand as a memorial for her whenever she passes on. But she didn't like that idea at all. She's a very humble woman and didn't think that, I think she thought there was a lot of ego to that. And so I was very pleased because she agreed to be interviewed, but I don't think, to be honest with you, she had a full concept of what was going on when she agreed to be interviewed and what it would be used for. So we put it together and he took it out to Alberta, and she just saw it a couple of weeks ago and loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it. Didn't realize there was all of that to say, and is very happy that that will now be there when she's passed on. And it's you know, it's funny because I could have spoken to her for hours. She had the, you know, we kind of, that's probably my only regret in all of this, is that you just kind of scratch the surface a little bit. And you want to go deeper and deeper and deeper all the time. And it's interesting, the Life Tales format, putting it into this documentary, is what makes it accessible to other people. Because the reality is, as interesting as these stories are, most of us won't sit down and listen to 5 or 6 hours of unedited interview, even if we are interested in the subject. I did this with my own aunt. I went to England and just turned the tape recorder on as we spoke for several hours. And although my own family, my own siblings are very interested in her and what she has to say, none of them have sat down to listen to it for several hours, because it seems to be hard to carve out the time, and you go through a lot of ums and ahs and conversation that some don't find as fascinating. But sitting down and listening to a documentary of an hour seems to just make it all come alive.
Mm-hmm. The way you describe it, it's almost like some people's wedding videos where they're like, oh, they have everybody around, come by and watch 6 hours. And after about 45 minutes, people are like, oh, I have to leave. I have to get up for an early meeting in the morning.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Although it's funny because out of this, one of the things that came out of this was that I found when I ask people who are in their 70s and 80s about how they first met, or, you know, how he proposed, or do you remember the first kiss? It's amazing how much becomes foggy and they don't remember. And so when my niece was getting married, I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do a love tale for you. And I interviewed her separately from her fiancé and took their accounts of how they met and how it started and their hopes for the future and so on, and layered them into their love tale. And so it was when we, you know, a month after the wedding, when everybody gathered and we're looking at photos and so on, and my sister said, I actually want to hear their love tale. And I said, well, it's up to them, you know, how much they want to share. So we ended up listening to it, and both sets of parents were in absolute tears over the whole thing. And at the end of it, they said, if you ever, ever think about getting divorced, we're locking you in a room with this and you just listen to it over and over again. And remember what it is you're doing. it was great. But I thought, you know, again, I did one for somebody else who wrote back and said, this is going in the safety deposit box. I just can already see the day I'm giving it to my daughter on her wedding day. And I mean, it's so remarkable to think that you've been able to do that in people's families. You know, my most gratifying thing was a recent email I got from somebody who said, I don't know if you remember me, you did in a life tale of my father about 3 years ago. Well, he passed away 6 months ago, and I listen to the life tale almost every day, and it gives me such comfort. And I just wept because I thought that's exactly what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. There must be some funny things that happened where you're interviewing, let's say, you know, somebody in their 80s or 90s about personal details of their life, and all of a sudden their children go, "Mom, how could you do such a thing?"
Well, I have learned that I don't interview, when I do the interview, the recorded interview, kids are not in the room.
It's probably better that way.
It's much better that way. Because the kids start to do what I did with my own dad. They start filling in blanks. And they start saying, "Remember, Mom, when you told us such and such?" And so Mom starts to just tell them what she thinks they want to hear. And it doesn't work very well at all. So, no, I do. I definitely take them away and do the interview. I'll do the consultation with the kids in the room, mm-hmm. but not the interview.
Not too long ago, there's an author that I interviewed, and she told me this funny story about when she was writing her first book. She was interviewing her mother to get some details. And she said at one point during the interview, her mom said, "Oh, yeah, you know, we needed to put money on the table, so I went to work in a brothel." And she was shocked. And she said, "Mom?" She said, "Yeah, you know, it was 1939. We needed to put money on the table, so I went to work in a brothel." And her daughter just almost fell over backwards.
Well, you know, it's but part of this, what's interesting about this is that when I did the one of the 92-year-old woman, her son who had hired me said that grandkids and great-grandkids were absolutely fascinated by this, and certain things they really had a hard time grappling with. And these are kids and maybe in their teens and 20s and so on. And that's that this woman had lost two siblings in childhood, which was not unusual for that time. I think one was a drowning, one was a farm accident or something. But it was so inconceivable to them that that hadn't destroyed her as a person. You know, we live in a time where we're sort of quite, you know, I don't know whether you'd say soft compared to our parents or grandparents, but our lives are not filled with nearly the tragedy that theirs were. Mm-hmm. And we forget that. And it's really interesting for the kids to go back and say, "Huh, I have an appreciation of why you're so tough, because you became that way for some very good reasons." And it's a really interesting thing. One of the things that I found quite remarkable is interviewing a number of people who lived in England through World War II as kids and asking them about bombing and their fears and that sort of thing. And they've all said pretty much that they didn't really have an appreciation of how serious it was. It sounds ridiculous when planes are going overhead and bombs are going down. But the parents, you know, in one case, the parents would make a game out of it all. And in another case, somebody would say, "Oh, that's old Mac down at the store rattling those bottles again. He's making a terrible noise, isn't he?" And that, you know, dutifully the little girl would trot off the next morning and give Mac heck and say, "You mustn't rattle those bottles. It's a big noise." Noise and so on. And Mac would say, "Oh, I know, I'll do better next time." But it's really interesting to me that they don't seem to bear the huge emotional scars. You ask them that and you dig a little bit and they say it was just what their life was. There was an acceptance. They, you know, in my father's case in England, the headmaster pulled them all in at one point and said, "Well, you know, if the Germans invade, it's going to be you that we're going to count on, because they won't notice you running all over and passing messages and stuff." And so these kids made maps of every gully and hedge and tree and roots and so on. And you know, as my dad says, they were almost ready for the Germans to come. They thought it was going to be a great game. Was it deceiving them? Yeah, but did they get through it? Yes. And then you compare that to the sort of psychological trauma of 9/11, and that was one day, and kids who weren't even close to it or you know, had to deal with it in New York City, having to go through the whole trauma of it. And I think it's a really interesting juxtaposition of the experiences.
One final question, Susan. Have you given any thought about doing your own life's tale?
I wonder if you should ask that. I was actually thinking that the other day. I'm not sure how I would do it. I'm not sure who I could talk to now. I know the tricks of the trade. No, I do. I do actually, and I've started recording at least little vignettes, even if it's not put together in some way. I've started recording at least little pieces of my life, so that hopefully, at one point, it will make sense to somebody, and it will be there. I think we all have that part in us that says, well, one of the sort of slogans that you tend to hear around the personal history field is, "Someone in the future is waiting to hear from you." And we all have that sense that we want to go back. In my own history, oh, back or I think around in the 1500s, apparently the family was quite wealthy, but we lost it all to one idiot who took up spider racing and gambling on spider races. Now, I want to know more about that guy. But alas, all I know is that he squandered the family fortune on the spiders. So future generations at least will know a little bit more about me than that.
Susan, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much for this, Keith. It's always fun to talk about.
And I was speaking there with Susan Ellington, creator of Life Tales. You can find out more information about them online at www.lifetale.ca. That's LIFETALE.ca, all one word, www.lifetale.ca. But you can also find the link at our website at pcjmedia.com and also take part in the new poll that we have running. You'll find everything on the homepage. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. On behalf of our technician, Kevin Lee, our production assistant, Johan Backer, who also now is helping us with the Spanish version of the show, La Sesión de la Alegría, this is Keith Perron all the way in Taipei, Taiwan, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.